Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a report from the American computer security company Mandiant, detailed in the New York Times, that accuses China's People's Liberation Army of being actively involved in hacking into U.S. government and corporate data banks, targeting critical infrastructure. Alan Paller, the director of research at the SANS Institute, who has testified several times before House and Senate committees, joins us to discuss what the administration is doing in both waging cyber warfare and protecting America's vital and vulnerable networks. Then, with the Chinese government denying any involvement in hacking, we will assess the extent to which China's military is autonomous from oversight by the Politburo. Scott Savitt, who is a visiting scholar in Chinese media studies at Duke University and a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International, joins us. We will discuss the new Cold War in cyberspace and how China's assertive and apparently independent military shapes foreign policy and regional relations. Then finally, we will speak with David K. Johnston, the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, whose latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. We will look into why a number of struggling state governments are losing billions in revenues to corporate tax havens, and also discuss the recent manhunt and shootout with a rogue ex-LAPD policeman and David's article at Salon.com, LAPD's Indefensible Dawner Pursuit. And joining us now is Alan Paller, who is the director of research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution and the principal cybersecurity training school. He directs the SANS's research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity Study. He has testified several times before both House and Senate committees. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Paller.
Good to be with you.
And given that there's been a lot of hyperbole going on about the Chinese cyber attack by the People's Liberation Army that came out of a report by Mandiant and was featured in the New York Times, it's hardly breaking news. But nevertheless, we have Representative Mike Rogers, who's the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, saying, "I call it cyber terrorism that makes 9/11 pale in comparison." How does it strike you?
I think hyperbole is the active word. We've been watching China for at least since 2002, breaking into a lot of systems, but they're clearly not the only country doing it. And the fact that Mandiant found a building where there are some people housed is not enormous news. What I think is important about this, though, is the number of companies. I think Americans feel that these attacks have been isolated. You hear one, you hear another, but in this one instance, you're hearing about more than 100 companies, and the number in the United States that have been sort of demonstrated to be deeply penetrated are easily in the many hundreds and probably in the thousands. So that's the only big news, is evidence that the numbers are large.
But it seems to me that if we have a kind of Cold War in cyberspace, then what they're engaged in here largely, between the U.S. and China, and I'm sure it's reciprocal, is cyber espionage. It's not actual cyber warfare, is it?
That's exactly right. This is espionage made easy. Computers are the Internet is God's gift to spies, because it makes things that used to be extremely difficult much easier, and they are doing it. At least 125 countries are actively engaged in cyber espionage. What does separate China from the others, not all the others, but many others, is that the PLA has an economic mission. The People's Liberation Army has an economic mission as well as a military mission. So they're using exactly the same cyber weapons against our corporations, against our law firms, against businesses of all kinds that they use against military targets. That does make China somewhat different from the other countries.
Well, it seems, though, that in contrast to China, you could make the case, assuming that we know exactly who is behind the Stuxnet virus that crashed the centrifuges in Iran's secret nuclear program. It's largely been attributed to the U.S. and perhaps Israel, That's not cyber espionage. That's cyber warfare, isn't it? And I understand the Chinese have the Iranians have retaliated against both the Saudi oil company and the Qatar National Gas Company.
I don't know where the line is between that sets off the word cyber warfare. To me, cyber is used as part of any major military activity today. The most interesting one in terms of what cyber can do is when the Israelis bombed the Syrian nuclear sites, purported nuclear sites in 2007. The Syrians had two new radars from Russia, the best in the world that Russia made. And when the Israeli planes came in, they were F-15s and I think F-18s, neither of which are stealthy. But the radars showed no airplanes. And about halfway through the attack, when there were some sounds and they could hear it, the radars showed hundreds and hundreds of airplanes, many more than were actually there. And that's the kind of use of cyber attack to enhance the effect of warfare. If you're going to try to take out a command and control system and you can stop them from using their defenses, it becomes much easier to do kinetic attacks.
Again, I'm speaking with Alan Powler, who's the Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution, and the Principal Cybersecurity Training School. He directs the SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity Study. He has testified several times before both House and Senate committees. Now, the White House, prior to this recent State of the Union, issued an executive order addressing cybersecurity, titled Improving Critical Infrastructure Cybersecurity. And also in the President's State of the Union, he mentioned cybersecurity. In fact, in many ways, it looks like what we're reading in the New York Times today is was already previewed by the President. I'll just quote what he said. America must also face the rapidly growing threat from cyber attacks. We know hackers steal people's identities and infiltrate private email. We know foreign countries and companies swipe our corporate secrets. Now enemies are also seeking the ability to sabotage our power grid, our financial institutions, and our air traffic control systems. We cannot look back from now and wonder why we did nothing in the face of real threats to our security and our economy. Now, as I say, it seems like a preview of what we're reading in today's paper, wouldn't you say, Alan?
Yeah, he had access to better data than Mandiant had about the attacks on the banks and others. But yes, it was definitely a preview.
So what is this executive order going to do in the improving critical infrastructure cybersecurity?
I think alone it wouldn't have done much. But the White House had a meeting on Friday when they released, they and an organization called the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, released a short paper, about 12 pages long, called Raising the Bar in Cybersecurity. So the executive order called for voluntary standards to be set up by companies. The problem was no one had a clear picture of how you stop these attacks. And this paper, Raising the Bar, from the paper from CSIS, actually has the only evidence that we have comes from the NSA, the U.S. National Security Agency, and the Australian Defense Signals Directorate, which is the equivalent of the NSA in Australia, that shows actually that these attacks can be mostly stopped and that the defenses are rather inexpensive. So what actually is going to come out of the executive order is much greater than people expected, because it came along with a prescription that actually can develop defenses that are at least 85% stopping things, and in many cases 100% stopping all of these attacks you're seeing right now.
Well, we know from the Cold War, Alan Powler, that there was, again, a lot of hyperbole about the missile gap and the bomber gap, and a lot of that turned out to be fictional and it just resulted in an escalation of arms on both sides. But there seems to be some real evidence of attacks here, at least in terms of espionage, not in terms of actual cyber warfare. So give us a sense of, again, you know, we've got Leon Panetta in October saying the United States is facing what amounts to a cyber Pearl Harbor. Recently in New York, speaking to some business executives, he said this is the pre-9/11 moment. The attackers are plotting. So again, where do we stand in terms of rhetoric and reality?
The attacks are real. As I said, they're used mostly for espionage, but they're also being used to prepare the battlefield so that kinetic weapons will work better. But what Secretary Panetta has also said, as has General Alexander, as has the head of MI5, is that the biggest problem we face isn't actually technology, it's skills. That we don't have the people skills, our schools are not putting them out, that can fight effectively in cyberspace. And China, for example, has a competition every spring in every PLA district where dozens and dozens of people who have been caught hacking or want to compete, and the ones who win have been caught hacking into the Pentagon, building new cyber weapons. So they have a massive national program to find cyber talent. Russia has had schools for hackers since 1994. The National Security Advisor told me about one in 1994. So we are way behind on skills. And there's only one program in the United States. Governor Christie's actually launching it, called Cyber Centers, that even has a chance to build the kind of manpower that we have. But there's a wonderful slide that the DOD uses that says, in the next war, the tanks will be people. And what they mean is that when there's cyber attacks, things happen so fast that you can't pre-plan your weapons. So you have to actually have people who can respond in real time to these attacks. And those skills are very much like fighter pilot skills. They take many thousands of hours to develop, and we have not been developing that talent. We're hoping the Cyber Centers program will be able to do that.
But that's not to say that we probably don't have the talent in the country. I mean, as much as our public school systems are collapsing, we still have a bunch of brilliant kids that hack, often maliciously and stupidly, but they do it. My understanding is that occasionally the FBI has hired some of these brilliant hackers. Is there a possibility that the U.S. is going to start finding all of these kids sitting in their bedrooms creating havoc and put them all in a big room and take on the world?
I think that's part of what Cyber Center is all about, is take the kids who have talent and try to save them before they become felons. Not much chance that after they've gone to prison that they'll be much help. But there are hundreds of thousands of young people in the United States and older people in the United States who've experimented with this kind of thing, might have done some testing and exploration, and they are definitely the kind of talent that the Cyber Centers program is looking for. So it's yes is the answer to your question, but not after they've become felons. In general, it's hard to get those people to work effectively in law enforcement and military organizations.
Well, I'm sure some people in the audience are wondering, you know, why we're embracing this kind of or licensing this kind of criminality. But I take it that, you know, the point is that the barn doors open, the horses down the paddock.
I was at a high school a few weeks ago, one of our magnet schools in the Washington area, one of our best schools, and one of the people with me is from the military, and he said, "How many of you have a computer at home? Please stand up." And then he said, "If you've ever used that computer to actually break into someone else's computer that you didn't have the right to be in, please stay standing." And 30% of the students stayed standing at this high-end magnet school. And one of the teachers said, "Not you too, Jenny." it's not a sort of criminality. Computer hacking right now, their brand is very much like video games were 20 years ago. They see it as testing themselves, building skills, experimenting with things. So what we want to do is give them a chance to use that for good rather than extending it so far that they become felons.
But in terms of international law and rules of the road, we even have laws of war. Banning chemical and biological weapons, etc. Why can't we ban cyber warfare?
Because it's too easy. Because you can ban it and not stop it, meaning you can have all the laws you want, but certain nations that are rogue nations will allow it and support it. And people within nations where it's illegal will do it because getting caught, it's very difficult to get caught in hacking. And when you get caught, the penalties are not high enough yet to make it onerous to even be caught. So we're at a stage where there are way too many attackers. We're not going to fix the problem that way. We're going to fix it by building better defenses.
Well, just in closing then, Alan Pala, where do you think, I mean, the big hole in this story is we hear all about what the Chinese are doing, the Russians are doing, etc., but we never hear what we're doing. And the assumption is that our military now, NSA, in fact, the former head of the NSA and head of the CIA, Michael Hayden, has an article at CNN where he's arguing that this vast unlocked powers of the NSA that could be used, that would, you know, that would just sort of wipe the floor with the US's cyber rivals, if you will. So do you have any idea of how much, what we're up to?
Most of that's classified, and once I turned 60, I wouldn't accept a clearance anymore because I couldn't remember what I could say and what I couldn't say. So I don't have detailed information about what we're up to. But we have many people. Sands is the main trainer of both defensive and offensive people in this field. And I know we have a lot of people. We just don't have anywhere near enough. And that we need to get the kids, tap the kids to be able to do more. But we definitely are active in cyberspace, both offensively and defensively.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here, Alan Pala.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Pala, who's the Director of Research at the Sands Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution and the principal cybersecurity training school. He directs Sands' research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity Study. He has testified several times before both House and Senate committees. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about how much the Chinese government really controls its own military. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Savitt, who's a visiting scholar in Chinese media studies at Duke University. He's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International, and his forthcoming memoir is on his 2 decades as an American reporter in China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Savitt.
Thank you, Ian.
And we've heard, of course, from the New York Times, who have had considerable problems with the Chinese government of late since they revealed the immense fortunes of the Chinese leaders, that there is this building on Great Harmony Road outside of Shanghai that is the headquarters of the Chinese military's cyber warfare unit. And, of course, this has come as no surprise to anybody who's known that Chinese military are behind a lot of the hacking that's been going on. So given that it's not necessarily a new story, what is your takeaway from it?
I just got off the phone with one of the authors of the Mandiant report that the New York Times story is based on. And so this is a little bit of exclusive information for your listeners. Is the reason this came out is because the U.S. government was getting ready to reveal this, and they tipped their hat to, you know, this quasi private. The Mandiant is the leading cyber security firm based in D.C. They have the guy I talked to was one of my former reporters in in Beijing. He's military intelligence, still active, actually. So a lot of military people working for them. And the U.S. government was going to reveal this. So they allowed this private entity to issue this report first. The problem with it is when you issue this report, you reveal your sources and methods. So the Chinese are going to change up as a result of this. So you would prefer not to do that. There's nothing new in this information. This is all very well known in the industry. The only thing that's happening now is, you know, you read it in the New York Times. Otherwise, this is standard operating procedure now. Military powers gather information on each other, and that's going to continue.
But what is alarming people from this New York Times Mandiant report is that this People's Liberation Army Unit 61398 apparently is targeting or planning to target U.S. critical infrastructure such as refineries, power stations, waterways, etc.
Well, we do that too. Actually, that's what you want your military to do. And the point is that you can claim that it's purely defensive in nature. This is what I'm emphasizing, is that, you know, it may have made very, exciting reading in your morning New York Times, but actually for people in the industry, there's nothing new about this, and that, you know, we're doing it to each other. Everybody knows. I mean, it's a little bit amateur for them to have been found out this way, you know, so people could just go right up to the building. That shows that they're getting a little more bold, because I think they would have done it behind military compound gates where, you know, nobody could have identified it previously. So, you know, that means something is different. And, you know, my guy at Mandiant just said, yeah, it means they're almost really not trying to hide it anymore. They don't care who knows. And you know, in terms of the incursions in the South China Sea with Japan, you know, playing chicken with Japan and painting, you know, their ships with radar, the Chinese, it's brinksmanship. And this is what's alarming people. And you know, the people I most respect, the analogy they use is this is Japanese militarism a la 1930s. And this is what probably the civilian leadership in China doesn't have complete control of the PLA.
Well, Scott Savitt, I'd like to get a sense of what that relationship is between the civilian leadership and the Chinese military. There was some doubt as to whether the new leader was going to even get the defense portfolio there for a while. I guess... Go ahead. Sorry.
He was always going to get the defense portfolio. It's just a question of time, and that's the part of the succession. They've institutionalized the leadership succession. The way it works is the guy in from Deng Xiaoping chose this guy, and then they skip generations. So it was a compromise for Jiang Zemin to come in between their various factions in leadership. And so you get to pick not your successor, but the successor of your successor. So that's where we are now. And the only thing that's not completely procedural is when he assumes this central military commission censorship, which has always been where that's why Chairman Mao was called Chairman Mao. That's, you know, the commander-in-chief is where the real power lies. I mean, you know, you're the leader, you're the de facto leader of the Communist Party, but controlling the People's Liberation Army is what is considered most significant. And, you know, it's already a done deal. What you heard was just conjecture, but everybody, you know, they horse-traded, and everybody said, okay, we'll all retire together. So at the March National People's Congress, Xi Jinping will take over the chairmanship of the Central Military Commission. And that's not subject to question, but just because he has the title doesn't really mean anything. The previous leaders, Deng Xiaoping, obviously, He was a Long March veteran. He was, you know, he was a military commander. He fought in the Civil War. So, you know, he had those credentials. And every generation since has had less credibility with the military. Up to this one, the most that this guy can claim is that his father was a Long March veteran. But other than that, you know, you're going to have young military guys the same age as him saying, Why am I going to take orders from this guy? You know, and this is the danger. This is why single-party states have a difficult time with succession because, you know, in our country, you have an election and, you know, the president is the commander-in-chief and, you know, it's treason if you disobey an order. And even then you find out that there are people who, you know, don't like it. But, you know, so far, nobody's there, you know, no coups in this country that were aware, or maybe there were, who knows, but, you know, in China, it's much more dicey.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Savitt, who's a visiting scholar in Chinese media studies at Duke University. He's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and the United Press International, and his forthcoming memoir is on his two decades as an American reporter in China. Well, Deng Xiaoping, of course, was the one who made the transition from communism to capitalism with a Chinese face. And part of what he did was encourage the military to go into business in order to pay for their own budget. And this has led to them being not just politically independent or in a murky kind of way, but also to some extent economically independent, although you said earlier that they get what they want at any rate. But my understanding is that, you know, there's some powerful dynasties within the military, like the Yang family. So,
very powerful. So, yeah, just to clarify, so Deng came to power after the Cultural Revolution. You know, this was with the military's backing. So Mao died, the Gang of Four, led by Mao's wife, is left in place, and within a month of Mao's death, they're under arrest. You know, Deng comes in with, you know, the Yang family, as you mentioned. I mean, these are the people who, you know, made it possible for him to take power. So starting from then, the fact that the military is involved in business is just that was given because, you know, China opened up to Western investment and the military was one of the most powerful institutions. And, you know, they did have all kinds of sprawling empires, like, you know, the brothels in Beijing were run by the military. I mean, crazy, crazy stuff. And so in the 1990s, after Tiananmen, they finally said, okay, you know, this is really unseemly. So they made a big push of the military getting out of private business, but all they did was put up front companies. I mean, you know, they're still, it's the largest, most powerful entity in China. They have, you know, they have their own food supply network. They have their own military airport system. They have their own telecommunication system. It's almost like, you know, they make the joke about Pakistan. They say it's not a country with an army; it's an army with a country. And there's a little bit of truth in that in China as well. So, like I said, the analogy people are using is 1930s Japan, where the civilian leaders really are not in control of the military. And I, you know, with North Korea, with Japan, they, you know, they have plausible deniability with all of this. And so it's very difficult to know. But, you know, I argue with people all the time who try and say, oh, no, the Chinese, they really don't want North Korea. Well, come on, North Korea can't even survive a day without Chinese assistance. So under those circumstances, how can you, you know, simultaneously say you're propping up a regime, but they won't listen to you? It doesn't make sense. Never mind all the, you know, all the technology comes from China anyway. So,
well, Scott Savitt, what happened at Tiananmen, though? Because I got the impression that the Chinese, the politicians didn't know what to do. You know, they'd created a mess with Hu Yaobang's death and the student democracy movement that sprung up out of that. And then they got rid of the progressive leader, Zhao Zhang. And then the military sort of saved their bacon, exacted a price, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So basically what you had was a divided civilian leadership, as you probably have now. And the thing is that
you know, I remember this very, very, I was a cub reporter. I was 24 years old. But the thing was that, you know, when the students started marching, I said, oh, they're going to crack their heads and it's going to be over. But nobody gave the order. And one day there were a dozen, and the next day there were a million people in the street. I mean, literally that quickly. And then it was something that the civilian leadership really couldn't deal with. So they had to bring the military in, and they had to make a Faustian bargain. And, you know, they declared martial law. They gave the order, come on in, and, really put a fright into these people. So, they don't dare to do it for another couple decades where we are now. And in the meantime, the military has gotten everything that they've wanted. You look who benefits. The military budget has increased annually. Nobody really says no to them. And now you have a situation where, you know, everybody's saying China's belligerence, it looks counterproductive. Why are they being so aggressive? And the only logical explanation is the military is calling the shots.
So in other words, the fact that China holds our debt, that there's a huge amount of trade going on, that China's trade is international and they're taking more and more of a role on the world stage, you're not of the belief that it's inevitable that the military competition will recede as economic competition and interconnectedness increases? That's the conventional
wisdom. Oh, no, on the contrary. I mean, they go hand in hand. This is tearing incognito because you had a Cold War with the Soviets, but we didn't have trillions of dollars of trade with them. You know, the whole thing about the debt, that's a red herring, because the Chinese, they have nothing else to do with that money but buy our treasury bonds. You know, we're mutually interdependent. So, you know, that one is just, it's a mistaken notion, but the trade is very significant. But this, you know, this idea that just because, you know, you have a massive amount of trade means that militaries don't compete, it doesn't make any sense. They both go on simultaneously. It doesn't stop the militaries from competing for supremacy. And the point is that, you know, the U.S. has been accustomed to being a sole superpower, and, you know, the China is the one entity that can challenge them, and asymmetric warfare makes it possible for, them to leapfrog, and that's exactly what's happening. That's what you're witnessing with all of this. Yep.
So, Scott, I thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, that's right. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Savitt, who's a visiting scholar in Chinese media studies at Duke University. He's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International, and his forthcoming memoir is on his two decades as an American reporter in China. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how a number of states are losing revenues to tax havens.
Protect yourself from digital decay. Digital
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, who's a professor of law at Syracuse University and president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, an educational organization with 4,200 members, a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto Tax Enforcement Officer of the United States. He wrote the best-selling books Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. He has an article at Tax Notes, Tax Havens Let Billions Vanish into Thin Air, and another at Salon.com, LAPD's Indefensible Dauner Pursuit. Let's start with the tax havens let billions vanish into thin air. How many states are involved in losing money? I take California is at the top of the list.
Yes, it is. All of the states allow these rules, as of course does Congress, under which corporations earn profits in, let's say, California, but they turn them into tax-deductible expenses and move the profits to places like the Cayman Islands and Bermuda.
So what kind of loss does the state of California incur? Because it's, you know, just today, Moody's didn't upgrade the state, but said that it was actually getting better, but it's still downgraded. And it's only one notch up from the state of Illinois in terms of being at the bottom of the barrel.
Right. Well, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group's Education Fund did a study, and its analysis was that California loses about $7.1 billion. Can you hold on a second? I want to get rid of that noise in the background.
Yeah, it sounds like the cook is throwing saucepans. Anyway, I'm talking here with David K. Johnston, New York Times veteran, Pulitzer Prize winner, the author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And we're talking about his article at Tax Notes. Okay, go ahead, Dave.
It's about $7.15 billion in California. That money comes in large part in California from corporations, more than $4.2 billion. That may seem like a very big number in California. It's about 40% of what corporations pay the state. But remember, California is home to companies like Google, which is very well known for its offshore tax strategies. It's home to the movie industry, and the movie industry has become particularly adept at earning money offshore and keeping it offshore. So that isn't particularly surprising. And then for individuals, the estimate was around $2.9 billion a year that individuals move out of the state into tax havens.
Well, you know, the state of Texas is saying, you know, come to Texas. You know, California is going to tax you. And, you know, the city of Los Angeles is thinking of having an extra sales tax as well. And, you know, the state of California introduced one to fix this, the decaying education system here.
And if you want to have an even worse education system, go to Texas. Texas has one of the worst education systems in the country. Last year, they cut an additional $5 billion out of their education system. And here's how much regard the current governor of Texas has for education. Back in 2004, he wanted to lower the taxes on mansions and wealthy people's homes. And instead of shifting that off onto poor people, he was going to make it up by having video lottery terminals installed at the gas pumps. So where you're gassing up your pickup truck, you know, you can gamble, and by charging, putting a tax on topless bars, which sort of gives a whole new meaning to politics and mother's milk.
So, David K. Johnston, what is the likelihood, though, of any of the big moguls? We're talking about corporate taxes, but right. I can't imagine Silicon Valley moving to Dallas.
Well, there is. Remember, one of the original big companies in this business was Texas Instruments. They continue to be there. You will see lots of operations probably moved out of California. There's a lot of work being done now in, for example, Idaho. Hewlett-Packard had big operations up in Idaho and to Texas. Corporations are going to go wherever they think they will get the lowest return or, alternatively, the biggest subsidy that they can get people to go. If they're jobs that involve a lot of talent, then they're in a little different spot than if they're a commodity job. If they're talent jobs, you know, A few years ago, Google's Motorola Mobility Division got a huge subsidy from the state of Illinois by threatening to move to rural Iowa. Well, there's no possibility that they would do that. The engineers and research scientists who live outside Chicago and who want its cultural amenities and big sports teams, they're not going to go to rural Iowa. But nonetheless, it got the state to give them, if I recall, $122 million in subsidies, and that's one of the biggest games these companies play. It's to get money out of the taxpayers. What's new, what this new PIRG study showed, and both the piece I wrote for State Tax Notes, which is free online at taxanalyst.com, and I rewrote it just about California for the Sacramento Bee over the weekend, is this idea of how much it's costing not Washington, but Albany and Sacramento and Springfield to have these offshore tax havens.
So just to finish up with this subject, because I want to talk about the LAPD. Obviously, it's a big subject here, and we just had another shootout, car chase, carjacking here in the Southland. The why do these wealthy and profitable companies, why are they haggling over what's really small change to them? The state needs them, the money badly. What's the problem?
I think, Ian, we've seen a complete breakdown at the very top of any sense of the social compact. I can remember when I was a young reporter, stories in the late 60s and early 70s about a company having to lay somebody off, and the president, we call them CEOs back then, we called them presidents, the president of the company would say that he was going to not take any pay raise or only work for his salary, no bonus or anything extra, until every one of those people were hired back. Now, CEOs practically dance up and down. Oh, boy, I get to fire more people and I'll make more money. There's been a real serious, serious breakdown. And it's because instead of thinking about the welfare of the whole society, we've created this society where at the very top, all of the social benefits and rewards that come to you depend on how many commas and how many zeros come after your net worth at the end of your net worth statement.
So again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnson, who is the president of the Investigative Reporters and Editors, an educational organization with 4,200 members. He's a 13-year veteran of the New York Times and won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting uncovering loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he's the author of his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Now, turning to your article at Salon.com, LAPD's Indefensible Dawn of Pursuit, was so much the subtext of the Dorner pursuit here in Los Angeles was that Dorner tried in his manifesto to suggest that the LAPD was still this racist organization that it was under Daryl Gates, and you reported then for the LA Times about it. But on the other hand, in Dorner's own manifesto, he gives a shout out to these racist disc jockeys here, Ken and John, I think they're called, and a guy called Bill Handel, saying, "Keep it up, guys." So he was, ideologically all over the place. But nevertheless, a lot of people in the minority communities, particularly those that experienced police abuse over the decades, some of them were prepared to believe that this guy was a victim. So it put the police chief on the spot, and seemed to be going out of his way to say, "No, we're not the LAPD of the Daryl Gates years."
Well, I think what this case shows is things haven't changed that much. Clearly, Dorner became deranged about what he was doing. That doesn't mean that things that he spoke about in his manifesto may or may not be true. But I think the important issue in this hunt for Dorner was how the police acted in two shootings, the one by the LAPD down in Torrance and then moments later by the Torrance PD. The LAPD, which I spent 3 years covering in 1980-83, I was the first mainstream journalist to seriously take apart and examine and document how the LAPD was operating, including all of the massive political spying and the brutality and whatnot, has written policies and training about shooting. You are not allowed to shoot at a moving vehicle, even if the vehicle itself is being pushed toward you, being driven towards you, except under very limited circumstances. And what happened here? Well, we've all seen the picture of that blue pickup truck with, it looks to me like at least 20 bullet holes in the back of that truck. The LA Times interviewed a man who had 5 bullet holes in his door, so there was a fusillade of weapons. Well, the pickup truck with these 2 Hispanic women in it doesn't even look like Dorner's truck. It's a bright blue Toyota pickup, and the truck Dorner was in was a gray Nissan. Minutes later, a surfer, a slight white male who looks nothing like Dorner, in a black Honda Ridgeline pickup. And anybody who's listening, if you don't know how different that looks from a Nissan, just go to the internet and put in Honda Ridgeline. It's a very distinctive, I would say ugly, but a very distinctive truck. They rammed it with their car, and they shot into this car. This was completely out of control, and there is no possible way that you can fit the shooting by the LAPD officers into the LAPD's training and policies. It's not within a mile of those policies. And yet what did Chief Beck do? He immediately moved to excuse this away, saying these officers were under tremendous pressure. That's absurd. And it is totally inexcusable, but it signaled to people down the stream in the police department how they were to deal with this shooting, that the chief had said, well, figure out a way to excuse away what happened here.
Well, at the time, he had to answer some of those questions. He did an exclusive interview with the local CBS Channel 2 reporter here, Pat Harvey, and he used that occasion, of course, to say to Dorner via television, look, we're going to revisit your case and rehear it. And it turned out, subsequent to that, there's been some reporting on exactly what the LAPD's review process is like, and it is definitely stacked against the complainant.
Oh, yes, it is. And the LAPD isn't unusual with that. It was very interesting that when Chief Beck did that, and I was pretty transparently, an effort to get to Dorner, assuming he's going to hear this message in the news, to try and, get him to ease off in some way and say, we're listening to you. You'll also notice that former Chief Bratton immediately gave an interview that poo-pooed that and undercut whatever Beck had done in an effort to get to him. But, I think this is a really important issue here, Ian, that there is a fundamental legal policy. A police officer does not have the right to kill you as an innocent person in order to protect himself. Now, back in 1982, I think it was, it may have been in 81, I was asked by Daryl Gates to go take the police department's shooting course up at the police academy. They have a large room where there's a huge aluminum screen instead of the kind of white screen you see at a movie theater. It's actually bent a little bit. And they play a movie. They give you a .38. You put on a Sam Brown. You get a .38 with plastic bullets. And the computer records exactly what frame was showing when you shot the gun and where your gun hit. I didn't have any advance notice of what's in this film, although I of course, figured most police officers did, and they showed a film in which an actual incident happened. 2 cops on foot patrol in L.A. walk past a bar. There's a commotion. They turn around. Bandits come out of the door of the bar. There's a woman pushing a pram with a baby in it and another innocent civilian. I allowed in the camera, this fictional episode here, my partner to get shot to death. And then I proceeded to shoot and kill both suspects. I got an almost perfect score. Put my gun back in the holster, turned around, the lights came up, and up above me was a television camera crew from the LAPD and still photographers. And I realized that what Daryl Gates had done had hoped that I would stupidly, wildly shoot my gun and on film kill the innocent person. They didn't know that I had used and owned guns and whatnot. But the lesson in that was, and I talked with the police department about it afterward at length, was about, sometimes your duty as a police officer is to die. That's a terrible thing, but you don't kill innocent people to save yourself. And that's exactly what the shooting of the Toyota Tacoma is about. It was officers afraid Dorner was in that truck and shooting without knowing who was in it because they valued their lives more than what turns out to be innocent civilians. That's criminal conduct. That needs to be seriously addressed and not, as Chief Beck has indicated, explained away.
Well, I think they were shooting. They weren't probably so much in their own lives were threatened so much as they were supposedly protecting residents where a high-ranking police officer.
Ian, that's going to be exactly that. That's going to be their justification for it and the excuse for it. But in the piece that I wrote for Salon, which is also at Alternet, there are links to the actual PD policy. You can read the LAPD's policies. And that shooting, yes, they were trying to protect people who were clearly targeted, and they should be doing that, or they should have people to defend them. These were two Hispanic women in a vehicle that doesn't look at all like Dorner's delivering newspapers. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, there was
a policy at all.
Sure, and they were very lucky to escape that fusillade of bullets. They could have been.
Oh, absolutely. One of the two women was struck, the other wasn't at all. And that goes to another point, by the way, that every study I've ever read of police shootings, even when there's very close-range combat, nearly all bullets miss. People are in a state of absolute terror. They're not. This is not the fictional Clint Eastwood characters where people are perfectly cool. And the slightest uncertainty and motion in your hand with a short-barreled gun causes bullets to go all over. There were bullets in trees and mailboxes and garage doors all over the place in this shootout, which I think is just absolutely indefensible. And people in L.A. should recognize that this is a real warning sign about the actual culture of the LAPD, not its written policy, not what the law says, but the actual on-the-streets policy. And that's why I did this piece, because it does show that 30 years later, after all these scandals, all these things that have come out since I did the groundbreaking work back in the early 80s, it hasn't changed very much.
Well, just back to the police chief Beck's appeal to Dorner to come in and they'd review his case. Obviously, it didn't work, but another deputy died, and another one was badly wounded. What did you make then of the use of the tear gas, which caught the place on fire? Is that a big deal?
First of all, let me be real clear. I don't give any quarter here to Dorner. What he did was criminal. It's outrageous. The police had to find him. That doesn't mean that they had to execute him. And now you get to this question of he's in this cabin. Now, he took some people hostage, and he said he wasn't going to hurt us. He didn't have any beef with us. So the guy wasn't mad dog out of control. He was focused on what he was doing and clearly awful. I mean, he didn't go kill the captain he felt had wronged him. He killed the captain's daughter and fiancée so the captain would spend the rest of his life feeling awful. I mean, that's pretty monstrous conduct. The tactics that were used once they had him in the building, what's the rush? If you know he's in this building and he's surrounded, what's the rush? And if you think there are innocent people inside whose lives are at risk, why would you fire tear gas canisters in a way that would lead to this fire? Why wouldn't you go in there? Oh, that would mean putting officers' lives at risk. You decide to become a police officer, you are making decisions, and if you volunteer for the kind of assignment like going into that building, they're not going to order people in that kind of a situation. They're going to take volunteers. Yeah, you may get shot or killed.
Right.
Police work, however, remember, is not that dangerous. There were a total, in recent years, there's been between 45 and 70 police officers a year killed in the line of duty by assailants. The death rate for fishermen, that's a death rate of about 1 per 100,000 police officers. The death rate, I'm sorry, 10 per 100,000 for police officers. The death rate for fishermen is 260 per 100,000. You're vastly more likely to die on the job if you are a carpenter working on the roofs of buildings than if you're a police officer.
Well, David, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnson, who is the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, an educational organization with 4,200 members. He's a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code. And he is the author of a couple of bestsellers, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. And his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. He has an article at Tax Notes and the Sacramento Bee, Tax Havens Let Billions Vanish into Thin Air, and another at Salon.com, LAPD's Indefensible Dawn of Pursuit. And this is Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. The rest of the program is available at ianmasters.com. The interview on the Chinese militaries, how autonomous they are from the Politburo, a very interesting subject to cover. So that's available at ianmasters.com in about an hour from now. We are in our first day of a new fund drive, and today we are offering up in this. We've done two-thirds of a program, which we're going to attempt to do throughout this fund drive. So we're giving, you know, the idea is to, the reason you support us is you like the programs. Well, then we give you as much of the programs as we can. And so we're doing much, much more programming and much less fundraising on the basis that that you would appreciate that. And in this last 15 or 20 minutes, we're offering up a great premium, something that is right in the news. In fact, the Academy nominations were just the deadline to vote was yesterday. So on Sunday, we'll be having the Academy Awards. And we've had here in the studio just recently the filmmakers of one of the feature documentaries that's up for the Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary, Five Broken Cameras. We are now able to offer that film up to you as a premium here in exchange for a $100 donation to KPFK at 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. That is the number to call to get this brand new DVD of a documentary that's up for this year's Academy Award. It's called Five Broken Cameras. The five broken cameras are the five cameras that this Palestinian farmer, a non-professional who taught himself how to use a camera, he decided to document his life as Israeli settlements encroached across from Israel towards him and started to swallow up his land. And he and his neighbors engaged in very creative, non-violent protest. The film is done in conjunction with an Israeli filmmaker, Guy Davidi. It was actually shown, financed by Israeli television, shown on Israeli television, although as a documentary, didn't get a lot of play. Presumably, if it gets the Academy Award, we'll get more so. But it's a film, really, that I think the American audience, more than anything, needs to see. It's such an extraordinary revelation about all this agony that we've been hearing about for so long between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And it's pretty no secret that most of America's politicians and the press in this country are extremely one-sided in believing that Israel is the victim and the Palestinians and the Arabs are out to kill all the Jews. But this film does give you an extremely different perspective. It's a very, very powerful piece of work. Again, the Academy Award nominated documentary feature, Five Broken Cameras, for a $100 donation here to Background Briefing. Alan Minsky has joined me, the program director here. Alan.
Yes, and I think what is incredibly exciting about getting this now as a way to support KPFK is here and here alone, will you get the DVD, will you get Ian's interview with the filmmaker?
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.